This is Extraordinary Lives, a podcast from the team at Lad Bible who bring you Minutes With. If you've ever watched an episode, you'll know the type of stories you can expect from us. Gangsters.
The police has come round with guns. No, they're right, now we're f***.
Hackers.
We hacked the Prime Minister of Tunisia.
Spies.
The whole of the area where we were was infested with Stasi vehicles.
And people who've been through unique experiences.
You know, one thing you should know about espionage, as well as bomb making, the first mistake is your last mistake.
In this new series, we get stuck into a more in-depth conversation with some extraordinary people who've led extraordinary lives.
I don't mind talking about it because I'm not ashamed. And I didn't realise that anyone would find out or know, or anyone would judge me for it.
I'm Ben Powell Jones, and in this episode, we sit down with Sean Langan, who spent 3 months as a Taliban hostage. Sean is a British journalist known for making documentaries in areas of conflict, war, and civil unrest.
I woke up one morning in Kashmir and I was consciously happy. Like, not like I wish one day I will be, or if I had this. I woke up going, fuck, I'm happy.
In 2008, Sean was making a programme which took him to the Pakistan border, one of the most dangerous areas on the planet, known as a Taliban and Al-Qaeda training ground. Whilst trying to make contact with associates of Osama bin Laden, he was kidnapped by the Taliban and imprisoned in a cramped basement cell along with his translator and guide. Sean was held hostage for 12 weeks.
So I was suffering from malnutrition and my teeth were falling out.
We hear how it was the thought of his two children back home that got him through the darkest times and how he had to call the UK himself to try and negotiate his release. And how, when he was finally allowed to go, Sean had a difficult decision to face after making a pact with his fixer that they'd either both live or both die.
Every sinew in my body wanted to be released to see my children. But I say I'm not leaving without my fixer.
This is Sean's story. So Sean, obviously we've met you before. Thanks so much for coming in again. But for anyone that's watching or listening for the first time, could you just briefly introduce who you are and what you're known for?
Sean Langan. I'm a documentary filmmaker and journalist, specializing in foreign war correspondent films. And I kind of spent 10 years doing all the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan. That's kind of specifically, I guess, what I'm... I'd hate to say what I'm known for. It's not like an achievement on my CV. But last time I was here... Speaking about the time I was kidnapped by the Taliban, but it's a bit like saying, you know, getting run over by a bus is an achievement. But
okay, I understand that. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to go back to the start. And could you just tell us a little bit about your childhood and your early career and kind of a potted history of how you became a journalist?
I grew up in London, North London, and I kind of fell into journalism. I was sort of like most people, I think. I didn't really have a vocation or direction. I was sort of just doing lots of things. But I sort of was the lucky first break I had was coming of age in the late 80s, just around the rave period, where Fleet Street newspapers suddenly had style art. They wanted to write about style, fashion, clubs. And, you know, they couldn't hire six-year-old journalists. So there was this break for young kids coming out. So I think my first gigs in journalism, and I'm laughing because I don't know why I gave it up. I was like a club correspondent or rave correspondent. So I would go to Ibiza, Barcelona, writing about clubs for magazines like GQ and Esquire. And, you know, I was paid to go raving and I could expense whatever young people do at those clubs.
Right. I guess a lot of them didn't have receipts on those expenses.
They didn't care. And, you know, I was allowed to come into work late. That's kind of what I was doing. And I remember but there was a downside. It's a first world problem, this. Mm-hmm. I found it interviewing DJs quite mind numbing, talking about beats per minute. And I remember sitting there interviewing, I think it was a Radio 1 DJ called Pete Tong. I'm like, there's got to be more to life. And so I literally went off, the Berlin Wall was falling, and I funded my own trip and I went to the Soviet Union just as it was collapsing. So I literally segued from rave interviewing DJs to foreign correspondent because...
Well, how old were you then?
It's about 20, 28, 29.
Right, okay. So do you think you were just getting to a point in your life where, like you say, there's more to life than this, but you were like, this isn't going to be the next 10 years, 20 years of my career?
I didn't really have a plan. I just had enough of interviewing DJs to talk about. But, you know, and it was lovely. I mean, it's lovely. What's not to like going to it? But it was really luck. And I always say this to my kids and friends that you most of us don't know what you want to do in life. And so I was writing for magazines, and where my TV career started was I was doing an article, freelance journalist, went to Kashmir for, I think, a magazine like GQ Esquire. There was a family, British family, whose kids had been kidnapped. So I was writing a story about this family. And it was before 9/11. No one had heard of Islamic extremists or terror. And the BBC had a series called Video Diaries where they gave members of the public a camera to film their lives. And they would never give it to journalists because they didn't want professionals. And this is a kind of sign of how unprofessional I was. Sure. They went, well, you're not a trained news journalist. You clearly spent going to clubs and things, but why didn't you have this camera? And because I hadn't had any news training, when I was in Kashmir filming this video diary for the BBC about me as a journalist with the families whose kids have been kidnapped, and then I went to try and meet the kidnappers, I didn't know how to tell a news story. So I would be interested in what I was eating and what the local population, you know, did they have a girlfriend, boyfriend? And so I just filmed my life without knowing how to do it, like John Simpson news reporter. And it was, the BBC looked at it and went, God, you're doing a news story in a non-news way. So that was the start of my TV career. So I ended up doing foreign kind of newsy stories, but in a non-newsy way.
It almost sounds like vlogging in a way.
I was an Instagrammer.
Yeah, you were influencer. Early influencer.
No, but I wasn't paid product saying it's a great hotel flight. No. Believe me. No. It was video diaries. I was very naive. I got ambushed by, I was looking for these young backpackers in a village in the mountains in there. It's beautiful. It looks like Switzerland would have done hundreds of years ago. And I was going to meet one of the kidnappers, and out of the woods come all these mujahideen. And I'm filming my video diary. No one's trained me how to do it. So I'm like this idiot savant, and I'm looking at the camera going, oh, coming up behind me like it's a pantomime. And I just carried on filming. So this whole thing's on camera, and this is my first ever documentary, and it's like a kind of what not to do in a war zone. And so they're all coming out shouting and screaming, and I had this lovely translator, and it was only 6 months later I knew what they were saying in the edit suite. This is how naive I was. You hear these, and one's an Afghan, one was a couple of Arabs pointing guns, and they're shouting, pointing at me, and my fixer, it's got a very calm voice. But when I got it translated, it's you hear me saying, is there a problem? Anything I can do to help? And my fixer saying, no, don't worry. But what we realized 6 months when I'm editing what they're saying, translating, one of them saying, we told you not to bring any foreigners. I don't know if I can swear, but, you know, we warned you, we fucking kill the foreigners here. And then you hear me saying, is there a problem? And my fixer says to me in English, no, it's fine. And then the other one says, right, we're going to cut his fucking head off. And I say, is there anything I can do to help? So in fact, I look back at that and think, thank God I didn't know what's going on. And that kind of innocence, naivety was quite useful at that. But that was the beginning.
But that, I mean, what occurs to me is if that had been me.
Yeah.
That would have been the end of I would have watched that in the edit suite and thought, well, that was a lucky escape. I'm going to go back to DJs and interviewing people in Ibiza. I'm going to go back to Pete Tong, yeah. That wasn't the case for you. So was it that you thought you'd really achieved something, or did you find it quite exciting, or how, because it's not even like you say, you weren't a trained journalist who were like, well, these are the risks of the job. You were someone that kind of blundered into it, had a pretty close situation.
Yeah.
Did that not scare you off?
No. So when I tell these stories, I'm not, that's the bit you tell, you know, like that, oh, I nearly got whacked. And actually at the end, when they all calmed down, they all said these mujahideen who are you doing this for? I said, BBC. And they went, we love the BBC. And they're all like shooting in the air.
Oh, God.
So it all ended well. And I think that kind of naivety, they could pick up on that. I was not a threat. But to answer your question, what really, it wasn't those thrills and the, you know, people think you've, me and my friends who do this kind of thing, have got death wishes or adrenaline junkies. And that's a small part of it because I'd been struggling as a freelance journalist, not sure what I wanted to do. I woke up one morning in Kashmir and I was consciously happy. Like, not like I wish one day I will be or if I had this. I woke up going, fuck, I'm happy. And it's because I'd found something I love doing, a storytelling, a vocation. It's the difference between a vocation and a career. It's something I loved. And you're in this fascinating new environment. And for me, and a kind of more serious thing, what's driven me is that there was this Polish foreign correspondent who said, you know, the real journalism is trying to understand the other side, the other point of views. So being paid, I wasn't paid much money, but to be paid to go off to hear other people's stories, other parts of the world, was just a dream come true. But for some reason, yeah, I did tend to end up rather a lot of these close calls. I think my nickname at Channel 4 was Dead Man Walking.
Wow.
Yeah.
Must have felt good when you go into situations having that nickname.
That story was, that nickname I didn't like. But
yeah.
So it didn't start off, that wasn't my initial drive. And I was, you know, I was 20-something and it was quite a thing. It was quite, I think it's because I didn't realize until you really suffer, you're not, it is a bit of a game. But that it at the beginning, that wasn't my main motivation.
Okay. And was there an element of, you know, presumably when people watched that video, they were going, wow, oh my God. Like, you know, was there a bit of like, yeah, I did that. You know, was there a bit of bravado there that you could put yourself in these situations that other
people?
Well,
so when I look, so funny enough, that documentary was 10 years before I was kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was kidnapped, and the irony is when I woke up in my cell one day when I was kidnapped thinking, wow, I haven't literally, in terms of miles, Kashmir is there and it's next to Afghanistan, the tribal. I was literally miles from where I'd started my journey 10 years before as a filmmaker. And I thought, I haven't traveled that far. My first story is about five backpackers who are kidnapped. 10 years later, I'm in a cell myself thinking I'm about to be beheaded. And I realized I would be like Icarus, that Greek myth of the young man flying ever closer to the sun and being warned by his father, because, you know, they had these wings made of feathers, that if you fly too close to that sun, you're going to burn out. But he was drawn to that. And I kind of was aware that as time went on, as you say, you know, I'd come back and it was literally people like, oh my God, this is like Sean's been attacked by a mob. In a lot of the documentaries, I was just avoiding being killed and laughing. And I think maybe there was this thing where subconsciously, I'd hate to admit it, that I was forever upping the stakes. I won't blame anyone around me, but there was the people commissioning me. It was part of that. If you're going to watch a Sean Langan documentary, you know there's going to be some close calls.
Mm.
So one has to be careful.
Mm.
But there, it's you're living the life, tripping the light, fantastic. You're doing good work. So I don't regret anything that ever happened to me. And and that's easy for me to say, but I've lost about 8 friends blown up or some committed suicide.
As a result of the job they were doing?
100%, yeah.
PTSD or something like that?
Yeah, and most were killed doing the job. I think about 8 or 9 of my friends have been killed.
Because what I was going to ask was, you know, when you're a young single guy trying to prove himself, going out to these things, sort of get that. But when you mentioned about the hurt it causes other people, did it sort of change when your children were born? Did that sort of make you want to not put yourself into these situations? Or was it still something that was...
Yeah. Well, to my slight embarrassment, no, I think that was actually when I was doing some of the most dangerous stuff.
Right. Wow. And was it just that, do you think at that point, I'm just trying to get inside your head a little bit with it, really. Was it something that didn't really occur to you? Did you not feel the sort of mortal danger?
No. Well, I look at my sons now, you know, well, I like anyone when in their 20s, you know, you're going off on a year abroad, getting wrecked, near misses, car accidents, and so on. I think It's different when you're a young person, because you're not. So I don't have that excuse. I'm supposedly a responsible adult. But I think it's very difficult to envisage, to really envisage your own death.
Mm.
And I remember it's almost impossible, especially for a Westerner, where we're not living amongst that fear of and the risk of being shot every day.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember I was with a British unit in Afghanistan, and when they were cut off, there was about 19, 20 of them, and they were surrounded by 500 Taliban, and it was so intense. And I remember that's I understood that meaning of bite the dirt, whatever it is, because I was literally trying to get further in an inch or two into the ground because the bullets were so intense flying around. And at that point, I remember like, what the fuck am I doing here? And because it was so intense and close, it was my first time in my life I was able to really like, wow, death is just an inch away.
God.
And I felt horrible.
Yeah.
And nothing felt worth it because I'm like, I'm in a ditch in Helmand, and at that point my children would have been 3 and 2, and it's just occurred to me as I'm telling the story, to my shame, even though at that point I thought I was going to die, and about a minute later an RPG airburst, these things which are designed to blow up in the air, and they shower down shrapnel, we heard it explode, and it showered, and it was like standing under a shower. Because you hear this, and I look at this British soldier, and we just think, we've got to be dead. And we look around, and somehow this shrapnel, some miracle, lands all around us without, because a little bit of shrapnel will just cut. So that was that time. I was making a film called Fighting Taliban with these British soldiers, but that was before I went off and got kidnapped. So to my shame, even though that's when death became a very a reality, and the consequences and the suffering it would have caused my loved ones, but I forgot that moment, I think.
Well, okay. I mean, that seems like a perfect point to get into that story.
Right.
How did it start? How did that project start?
Well, this was picking up on your thread that, you know, that each doc... I think, you know, the first documentary I did was a completely legitimate reason for journalism. It was a good story. Happened to be involved, and I was abducted briefly or ambushed by these Islamic mujahideen. So then you next stage, well, why don't you do the Taliban in Afghanistan? And then, wow, that's like pretty hairy. Why don't you go to Iraq, do the war? And by this point, all my documentaries are about insurgents, US combatants or British and civilians. So the level of violence, rather like the level of violence in the Middle East, was just ratcheting
sure.
up. And I did this two documentaries were very successful, called Meet the Taliban, Fight the Taliban. We're in both of those films. There was a lot of fighting and near-death moments for me. And that was the one where I'm with a Taliban guy who says to me, look, you don't want to do this too often. We took a vote before you came down on whether to kill you, kidnap you, or do the interview. And he said, you're lucky this time the vote went your way. But you'll never know which way we've voted until you come here.
My God.
So I knew that. And that was a film called Meeting the Taliban. And yet the year later, that was when it was like, okay, well, that was a big six. That went down really well, that documentary, where I'd been warned, don't do this. And I ignored that warning like Icarus, going flying to the close of the sun. So the next documentary, this when I got kidnapped, and I'll give you the TV proposal.
Sure.
But it reads more like a suicide letter. So in this proposal, and it's my proposal, I mean, I'm responsible. So the idea was, you know, I did a few films in Afghanistan. But everyone in Afghanistan, soldiers, everyone knew that it was across the board in the tribal areas of Pakistan. That's where there was the training camps, Al-Qaeda training camps, secret training camps. That's where Osama bin Laden was thought to be. So in a way, no one had been there, but all roads lead to there. That's where you wanted to go. So my proposal, which the broadcaster went, good idea, was to cross from Afghanistan, which is pretty much the most dangerous place in the world, but I managed to find a more dangerous place to cross into the tribal areas where no foreigners are allowed. And if
so they're not even allowed there?
No, it's literally signposts saying no foreigners beyond this point.
So why would you do that?
And I used to laugh going, that doesn't mean Osama, you know. Well, and then I don't ask. I mean, Every time you ask that question, I'll go red with embarrassment. Before I answer that, also Pakistan had denied to the world there's any terrorist training camps.
Mm.
So they would, I'm sure they would, Pakistan themselves wouldn't, but you'd get killed for being there, for showing that Pakistan wasn't quite telling the truth when it says there are no terrorist training camps.
Right.
So the idea was to be the first person into these, and I'd spent months negotiating with the Taliban to make a documentary about their secret training camps.
Why would they do that? Why would they agree to let you do that?
You're going to keep asking these questions and make me look like an idiot. Turns out they wouldn't do that.
Right, okay. What's the benefit to them to having a BBC documentary coming or whatever?
Channel
4 or... Yeah, or whoever.
So, well, it's the same now. You know, wherever you go in the world, everyone wants to be understood.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we're less aware of the rest of the world being one of these major capitals and cultural centres. But the whole world, you go to any village anywhere in the world, they'll know about English football players or the mm-hmm. Premier League. They'll know about TV or, you know, the Taliban love Mr. Bean videos. I mean, I've been sitting in a village and they'll be showing me a video of a beheading. And the next thing is Mr. Bean.
Wow.
I think they were trying to talk to me, show me videos. And then Mr. Bean came up and I'm like, and they're like, oh, sorry. And they love Mr. Bean. So they know all about us. And actually, wherever I've been in the world, there was this, I sense this sort of pain that why don't you like us? What's wrong with us? And they want us to respect, to like them, to understand them. There's a genuine desire on that part to be understood. That's why and they love the BBC. I mean, we can mention the BBC. I don't mean to be political, a tragedy if the BBC is getting cut all the time, because wherever you go in the world, people listen to the World Service, local language of the Taliban. Mm. So it's an amazing resource. So when you turn up saying I'm BBC, they're like, we want to speak
right.
to BBC. Less so to other channels, but so, and I, that was part of my shtick. I would say to them, it's in your interest. This is my shtick with, I'm using that, but my way in with Islamic insurgents, it's like, you're fighting jihad, holy war.
Mm-hmm.
And you're using a weapon, but the word is part of your, so that's what I said. Now, actually, when I got kidnapped to do those training camps, I genuinely believe what happened was some of the commanders thought it was a good idea. I said, it's in your interest. I mean, it's not really an interest to talk about secret training camps, but I was saying it is. And some thought it was. And the guys who I negotiated with genuinely thought, this is good. Good for us, good for the movement. A few other people in other events went, that is not a good idea. And someone in Pakistan might have thought that's not a good idea. I don't know. But so when I went there, there was obviously, some have said, let's kidnap him.
I guess it's maybe the vote again. You know,
the vote 100% went against me that time.
So you arrive in the area where you're going to do the crossing.
Yeah.
At what point did you realize something was off?
So the weirdest thing is most abductions begin with, the classic abduction is, you know, hood over your head, bundled in the back of a car, gun in the face, fear. And actually, the beginning of my kidnap started like every one of my other, in my documentary when I went to meet Taliban. So when I used to, when you talk about, I never enjoyed the whole process of meeting insurgents in Iraq, Afghanistan, because it's ulcer inducing, because they're under huge risk. They think you're mm-hmm. going to set them up,
right.
Or you're being tailed by CIA or special forces. So they're nervous. So when they get you to meet them in the middle of nowhere and you're waiting in a really dangerous area, and in Iraq and build up areas, I remember just sitting there with other people who would want to kidnap me or kill me, and I'm trying to meet some guy who doesn't turn up. So it's incredibly stressful. And I had often, when I'm meeting and interviewing people, been blindfolded, put in the back of the car, taken to a secure area to film. So this time, when the car meets me on a side of the road near Peshawar in Pakistan, there's a mullah, young guy. It felt great. I'm great. I finally met these Taliban contacts. They're going to take me to where I needed to interview. And they said, look, just keep down and in the back of the car with the shawl when we go through checkpoints. So it was feeling like good news.
Smoother than usual, if anything.
Well, yeah, this is going well.
Mm.
There were some bad signs on the way up when the young guy didn't have a beard. He had like Prada gun belt and he had a Glock gun. And I was thinking, he's not right, this guy. And the Mullah, who I later called Mullah Medicated, these were some warning signs, but you're now in this car going to the tribe areas. He had like all these medicines in his bag and any pink, yellow, blue pills. And he said, I take these for my headache. And I look at them. One says, because it's all like little bits of the paper, prescription, or one said for severe psychotic disorder.
Oh my God.
I went, you're taking these? He goes, headache. I'm like, that's a bad headache. So the two men I'm in a car with, Mullah Medicated and a young Gucci Taliban with his.
Just for anyone that, it's kind of like regular parlance, but for anyone who isn't sure, what is a mullah?
A mullah is it's a religious, it's a priest, the equivalent of in Islam.
So it'd be a senior member of that?
You can be a village mullah, educated, but it would be traditionally someone who went to a madrasa, religious school, called a madrasa, has had some learning and is now a local, and there'd be different levels, but they're supposed to be a learned religious man.
Right.
This guy, I don't think, could barely read. I'm being serious. He probably couldn't read the Quran in Arabic. They learn by rote.
Yeah, okay.
And he was so off. His eyes were rolling. So I called him Mullah Medicated. Anyway, you meet sort of colourful characters like that.
Sure.
I get in with. And it still felt good. And we drove into the mountains. It's like a day's drive. And then And I remember, I don't know if I told you this last time, but then, you know, I then was this young Gucci guy, and then this other man joined us with an AK-47, and they asked if they could blindfold me. So this was my first, and then as I'm being blindfolded, I suddenly think, oh my God, this is, you know, bearing in mind that Taliban commander's warning in my previous trip where there was a vote on whether to kill you, kidnap you, or let you do the interview. I was like, oh God, maybe the vote's to kill me because I'm now being blindfolded because I was looking over at a precipice.
And were they being fairly cordial still?
Yeah, very cordial. Yeah. Do you mind if we blindfold you? And I was saying,
there's not much you can say that to that, is
there? Very polite. Actually, and I did talk about it. So, but it was where I knew I was kidnapped was, so I was sent into a house, put into this guest house, guest room, which they boarded up. I think it had previous occupant was goats because it stank of like goats. Tiny thing. I was on my own. And they said, we're just going to keep you here to make sure you're right. No one has followed you. We don't want the CIA or America, British, whoever. And then you can film in a couple of days. We're going to let you interview Al-Qaeda, whoever you want. So for the first 2 days, I'm sitting there thinking, I was already kidnapped, thinking this is going well.
For the two full days?
I mean, I had some feeling that Mullah Medicated and Gucci kid with his Glock.
And were you on your own or were you?
I was on my own because
there's no fixer here.
He was traveling separately for our own security, they said. Well, I'd been filming with Taliban or Iraq insurgents where you're surrounded by guys with guns and waving knives and it went well. So it seems ridiculous that I am saying this is felt good, well, but it was no different to my other experiences. Where suddenly then you're out, you've got 50 guys. I mean, the time in Iraq, in Afghanistan, when the command had warned me, you don't want to do this too often, I'd planned to meet 4 or 5 Taliban. And it was about 5 minutes from the main British base, and 60 Taliban just roll in and RPGs. And I'm just like,
right.
You know, it's like, fuck, you know.
And are they feeding you and giving you water and all that sort of thing?
What,
now?
I'll never forget the commander who was both charming. He had to charm with the devil because he'd be very charming. And then later on in my captivity when teeth were falling out, he'd be like, whatever. He said on the first night, what would you like for breakfast? I went, fried egg. The next morning they bought me a fried egg. And like, you see, like, how good the service is.
Wow.
I knew there was a dawning feeling a sort of slow, creepy feeling over the horizon that I was trying to keep at bay, that this was not right. And to be honest with you, slightly to my shame, before I even left London, I was saying my goodbyes because there was a feeling this time wasn't right. And you do develop a sixth sense. Mm-hmm. But I ignored that. And it was a very strong feeling that I wasn't going to come back alive or something was going to go wrong, seriously wrong. And I kind of put that out the back of my head thinking, and I look back and I regret not listening to that. Mm. So I had a bad feeling even before I left London. I wake up at 7 a.m. in my bed. It was like watching a theatre take place in front of you. The commander's shouting at the Muller who'd brought me, who was my main contact. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered later was he was questioning him, maybe you're involved with these foreigners. How come they contact you? Because they don't trust anyone. And like any insurgent fight, there's spies within there. So they're forever killing their own, arresting their own, just in case they're working with the Americans. So in front of me, the commander's threatening the Mullah, who then gets two men come in and put a hood over his head. And he's crying and they drag him out. And it's literally just happening where they say, this is a door. And I'm still sitting up in bed, having watched this sort of silent movie, understanding what's going on because it's obvious. And then he's outside the room, and I can hear the guards hitting him and the thwack of an AK hitting his face. And the commander's looking at me the whole time, just smiling.
Smiling?
Yeah, he's got this smile. And then the bodies, I can hear the body being dragged off. And you're waiting for the shot, but you don't hear. And he just says, don't worry about it. We arrest and kill our own all the time. It's no big deal. He said, and now we're going to check on you two. He's talking to me in my face. He said, and don't worry about it. It won't be like that case, Ajmal. Ajmal is the man I told you about who I'd climbed down the mountains. He'd been killed by the Taliban when he was doing another story. And that was embarrassing for the Taliban because they killed him, but they let the Italian foreign journalist live. He said, it's not going to be like that case. That was embarrassing for us. You'll either both die, you'll both live. And he walks out the room, and I turn to my fixer and laugh. Well, that's good news, you know. And that's when it, you know, gloves were off. We were kidnapped.
And, I mean, so when he was doing that and he was smiling at you,
yeah.
Do you think that was intimidation or do you think there was just something missing?
That's what I decided to think. He's a slight, maybe a sociopath. Or he just was looking at me as a man's getting, like we're all listening to someone being beaten with their rifle butts outside. Well, there was a lot going on, I think. I mean, and the other man, I mean, I didn't have that much. I mean, it's horrible. It's horrific here in the Neu, but that Muller medicated the night before was sleeping in my room. I woke up and he was on my bed with a knife at my throat. And I literally woke up and he said, don't worry. He was holding a knife. He's like, it's not for you. I just wanted to show you. He was on psychotic medicines, antipsychotic. He said, I just wanted to show you the knife I cut the throat of Americans with. And he jumps back on the floor and he's got that kind of sweat as someone who's on lots of. And he's explaining via my translator how he'd killed this American, slit this throat. And then he says, and he'd read the name of the guy's patch. He said to me, do you know him? It's like he's assumed we all know each other. And I felt I'm sorry, this is rather dark, but I felt, and I'm like, wow, this guy, that's one of the, he was one of the other people you meet, you think you are.
Yeah, because reason. I mean.
He was, you know, he's not properly religious. He was just like, a guy on medication.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm sure he wasn't a fighter, I'm sure. Anyway, so he was the one they arrested. And
did you see him again or not?
Well, here's the thing. So it's such a when in kidnap, they're worried about, because he lived in Afghanistan, I did see him later. So I thought they dragged him off to be shot. I met him just when I was released. So I was never sure if it was a play act to confuse me. So I wouldn't, if I was being debriefed by British police after, I wouldn't say, oh, well, he's the man who brought us. Because and they didn't want me to see him. I just happened to see him in the compound as I was leaving. So you're in a dark world when you're kidnapped and, you know, there are spooks and various international organizations are listening in and you never know who's the good guys, who the bad guys.
Okay. I mean, It sounds like the bad guy is the man at 2 a.m. with the knife to your throat.
he's not a good guy.
No, he doesn't sound like a good guy. Okay, so the pennies dropped, so to speak. Was your fixer native?
Yeah, Abner.
Yeah. So how was he taking this?
Well, much worse than me initially. Very quickly had some, you know, severe health problems, bleeding, internal bleeding from the, and he had a breakdown. So that forced me to be even more of like the PE instructor, the strong one, to say, come on, keep going. He had a very difficult time. But that's got nothing to do with me being more adept or a stronger character or physically more or mentally stronger. It was my Western naivety.
Mm.
And this is why I was like shamed, because I wasn't making like, I didn't think I'm better than you, but what it was I didn't want to think this is my Western ignorance, naivety, that my naivety is that it must be really difficult to take another man's throat and cut it or shoot a man like that. Being Afghan, he knew how easy and common it is. And he had actually fought in the jihad against the Soviet Union, the Holy War, they called it. He'd been a brave warrior. And yet he broke very quickly. And at the end of, towards the end of our captivity, so what was making me strong was just my ignorance, that it's very hard to kill another fellow human being. Well, his life experience was, no, life's cheap. And people get shot all the time and heads cut off. And towards the end of our, and it got very difficult actually, because he was my lifeline and I needed him to translate so I could bond with people and again, try and get a phone call to, you know, my outside to get rescued. So I had to keep him alive. It was real. So it's this very powerful relationship. But at the end, we had a candlelight. We knew we were going to be released soon. And he was on his knees, you know, because he's just finishing prayer. So then at the end of prayer, in the evening prayer, he's then just on his knees, relaxing. And we've got candlelight. And I'm sitting on my bed. And he's saying to me, you know, Sean, with tears in his eyes, you know, I'm a bit ashamed that I wasn't so strong and I've been a bit weak, but this wasn't my first time. And I'd known him for 10 years. He'd never told me the story, but he said, you know, this is my second time I've been captured. First time was when he was 9 years old as a young kid Afghan fighting the Soviets, but he was too young to have a weapon. He was handing out leaflets against the communists, the Russians, and saying, you know, calling jihad. And he got captured by communist secret service, local Afghan and KGB forces, put in a cell with three or four other kids, and they tortured, like beat them so much and used electric cattle prods. He was badly beaten, tortured, but never broke, never told them anything. He said it was like an adventure. And when he got out, his mum didn't even recognize him. And he said, but once you've been through that, you can never do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that to me was just one of many valuable lessons. But so why I coped well in there was purely because I've had a nice life where we also brought up that life is precious. Humans have got goodness. And so that background of mine helped me was, you know.
So that, how long were you captured for in total?
About 4 months, just under four months. Yeah.
So talk, like, I mean, that must have felt, I imagine, like a lifetime.
Yeah.
Yeah. So talk us through.
Right, every minute can feel, or a second can feel like a lifetime.
Sure. That's so you realize that you're captured, and then starting the next day, what's your kind of daily life?
Yeah. You go through, so you know earlier you asked me, how do you do things when you're clearly taking risks? And I was saying it's hard to really truly envisage in your own death. And one thing I was remarked about this experience was it was the first time in my life, apart from one or two instances where a bullet had just missed my head, but that's a kind of momentary realization that death could come and then you forget it. This was the first time in my life where the awareness of the imminency of my own death hit me, and it hit me like a physical, I was standing there when I'm realizing with about day three or four, like, fuck, you know, this is, because when they first tell you, it doesn't sink in. And they're telling you, you're under arrest, you're kidnapped. I remember reading, they had it, you know, a Taliban official paper. You're hereby under arrest and charged with enemy government spies or something. And I'm like, oh, man, we've been kidnapped. And, you know, my fixo is much more realistic. It's like, no, we're dead.
Right.
You don't get it. And it took a few days. But when it sunk in, I literally felt this physical, with the wind taking me, and I literally fell back on my, and that was like death. Like, I'm right here. I'm outside the door. And so you then live with death. And it was like having the sword of Damocles hanging over you, because you're aware every moment. And what happens at that point is you go into autopilot, and it's amazing. And literally, I've talked to specialists about this. Your lower part of your brain, the amygdala, the ancient brain, literally kicks into action and turns off your frontal. The parts of the brain that make us advance, you know, that conscious thought, well, that goes, they literally turn it off, because the lower part of the brain says, leave this to me. You're in a car crash. You're going through a windscreen. This is what I deal with, you know, fear of flight, survival. And I just didn't have to think about anything. I just knew, right, I've got to batten down emotional hatches. I've got to do exercise. I've got to, because it just all just seemed natural, survival instincts.
And were you trying not to think about it too much, or did it just take over and happen on its own?
You're, it got into, now the bits, now the, well, one of the things that happened, but again, it's on automatic. They talk about the drowning man syndrome. When people are drowning, they see their whole life flash before. Mm-hmm. And there have been recorded instances where people say, wow, my whole life. Well, I had that, but it wasn't flashing because I wasn't drowning. I had for about 4 days, and you have to know you're going to die for this to happen. I could see my whole life before me. It's like Scrooge on the night before, you know, Christmas
James
Eve.
Carol. Yeah.
With the ghost of Christmas. Literally, I sat on my bed, and I could pick age 5, first day at infant school, and I see myself, what I was wearing, my teacher who I named. I managed to name, I think, 14 school teachers. I could see the first day I met my best friend, what he was wearing. Cool. And apparently that's your brain, again, thinking, this body I'm trapped in is dying. It's about to die. So it's getting so many chemical messages of adrenaline and, like, all the alarm bells are going off in your body. And the brain is like, it's clearly like, I don't know what it needs, so I give it everything. So there might be something in this person's memory from their life that will help them survive this moment. And it was amazing, because stuff I'd thought I'd forgotten. So I'd read a book, you know, about a SAS guy captured behind enemy lines, his survival techniques, a movie I'd seen about, you know, just keep going. Everything I'd picked up, fragments in my life, which I thought I'd forgotten, suddenly were like, oh, yeah, well, I use that. You know, I'd seen that in a movie or read it a book. And the other thing that kept me going with this total recall of my life was you don't want to think about the fact that you could have your head cut off or shot. And you don't want to think about the suffering your kids. So you control emotions. But I escaped every day from my dark cell on that experience into conscious daydreaming. So I would sit on my bed and say, right, you know, I'm going to... And I could remember every school holiday, summer holiday, that idyllic, and your childhood summer holidays, and I was lucky enough to have had nice childhood summer holidays, or, you know, some sunshine, sea. My mother's Portuguese, so, we went lucky enough to go to Algarve. That became my safe space, and I would sit there, and there was a tiny hole at the back of the dark cell. It was about that big, and if I looked through, I could see an apricot tree, and just beyond that were the fields and the mountains. And I would look and hear the bird song. So it was quite an intense spiritual thing, but that's all automatic. I didn't know anything about that. And it really is powerful. And it's so powerful. And I don't want to, you know, I'm a cynical old hack, but there was this, you're so in tune with your loved ones and life and how wonderful life is. And you're also painfully, acutely sensitive how fragile It's literally, there was a spider's web outside the hole with, and I would see it in the rain and a raindrop. And I'm like, my life is, you know, hanging on a thread.
So while all this is happening, all the stuff that you're thinking about, the time you're spending in your head, basically,
yeah.
What's your contact like with your captors? Like, what are they telling you? Are they telling you you're going to be executed? Or are they saying, we're just going to hold you for a while? What's that like?
No, the actual house I was in, the Taliban safe house, was owned by a family, you know, like six brothers. You don't meet their wives, you know, they're in, kept away. So, but it's a family compound. And they were like friends with the Taliban, working with them probably. Strong sort of, you know, guys. And the Taliban would come and go. They had bases in the mountains. So my interaction with the Taliban would be, they would come in, very charming commander, but, you know, it was...
This is the smiling guy.
Smiling, yeah. who I know would just turn on a dime. But my main interaction was with the family of the household, who were pro-Taliban, Pashtun warrior class. But the interaction, you know, I told him that last time I was here, when they were asking me, the Taliban, that charming commander, asked me the names of my children. I refused to give it to him. And then he threatens to shoot me. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't give you that, my children's name. And then he threatens to kill my fixer. So I say, look, all right, my son's name's Gabriel, which is one of the holiest names in Islam, the Archangel Gabriel, who brought down the Quran, the Holy Quran, to the Prophet. After that, all the family just they transformed how they saw me, because the Taliban had said, look, these are spies, they're unbelievers, because the Taliban don't like admitting we kidnapped journalists.
Mm.
It kind of doesn't look good, and for money. The families then knew that was just rubbish. And so we developed a very strong labor, and I taught the children English. The women, I found, were this amazing invisible support unit. They'd be singing outside my room to lift my spirits, but they heard, they never saw me, I never saw them. But they were great comfort and support. So I was suffering from malnutrition, and my teeth were falling out. Because it's funny, without sunlight, your body just...
Oh, really?
Yes, amazing. So
teeth falling out?
Yeah, yeah, without vitamin D.
Yeah.
Because we don't think there's much sun in England, but actually you're still getting sunlight through the clouds. So if you're in a dark cell for 3 months under that kind of stress, and the food wasn't great because they're in the mountains, there was a lack of fresh vegetables, fruit, a lot of stringy chicken in a press cooker. I lost about two or three. I had dysentery as well, because that room was full of, you know, it was a room for animals. So I lost 3 stone, had dysentery, and 3 or 4 teeth fell out. The women must be hearing this, so started going to great lengths, like climbing 6 hours walk up a mountain to get some fresh herbs or vegetables to improve my diet. And my diet, they built up my strength. So it was this bizarre, really intense relationship between me, but never what they call Stockholm syndrome. You know, I never... No.
But it's interesting what you say.
Especially not with Mullah Medicaid, with that, you know...
No, sure, yeah. But it's interesting what you say about, you know, they must have been fed a load of lies about who you were, because once they started to think that you weren't some ungodly unbeliever that was out to punish them and poison all the community or whatever, they were actually... could they have got in trouble for trying to help you like that?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing that this happens where this goes back to, you know, the original, why do you want to go out to the world to try and understand? They're off, you know, these average rural people in the middle of nowhere, funnily enough, it's, you know, first time I really lived in a Pashtun Afghan home. I'd always been in a guest house hotel going into their lives, but never living. It's the first time in 20 years of covering Afghanistan they opened up. So the young, they were all Taliban, but they opened up about how, you know, the young boy didn't have a beard, probably hadn't grown probably yet. He got beaten by Taliban at checkpoints. He said, you know, they're all just criminals, the ones who joined the Taliban. And they were, of course, this young boy didn't want to be hit, but you'd never criticize the Taliban to a foreign journalist. But I was no longer this foreign journalist. I was now a guest in their home. He liked Bollywood music. he fell in love with the girl. And you realize it's not like, you know, the news reduces people down to headlines.
Mm-hmm.
It's happening now in Ukraine and Russia, good guys, bad guys. And the world's just nothing like that. So there I am within this family.
But would you ever have lent on them in terms of saying, can you help me get out of this?
Well, I did.
Okay.
Yeah. And it got to that, well, yeah. I mean, I think it's probably enough time has passed. The Taliban left a sat phone there. And I spent 6 weeks to 8 weeks trying to convince the owner of the house to let me phone my... had to step by step slowly because they're aware it's an incredibly dangerous situation. They could get blamed. And it went wrong a few times. But it was like, you know, again, I'd read enough books and films, you know, you slowly do these things. You don't just... So I worked over conversations, got them to like me first. And then I was saying, look, because they were like, when this is all over, it'll be good. And I would say, but hang on, my mum may not live through this. She could have a heart attack. And if she's dead when I come out, I don't care what happens to me. And I wish I could call her now to say I'm safe. So they actually got to the point where they let me make a phone call. And it probably helped Channel 4 locate where I was. So... It did, but they got to point, though, where, well, this is the thing. They realized when I was rescued or released that this was a safe house for the Taliban, but not for the family who owned it. Because the Taliban weren't living there. There's this weird thing where the owner and me were sitting there, and I wanted to let him know that to try and get him to let me phone Channel 4 to give me this sat phone, which I did call Channel 4 with. And I was trying to push him, and then it occurred to me, fuck, he's thinking now as well, Sean, at the moment I'm in charge of Sean, but when I'm out, they all think we're going to talk CIA, that I could tell the British Secret Service that's the house I was in. Mm. They would bomb. Because when you're sitting there, you hear the drones hitting village houses nearby. They're like blowing up. So they're very aware. And I suddenly realized, and I'm trying to get him, that I was trying to say, look, you want to help me because then when I'm out, I'll let everyone know you're a good guy. And then I suddenly realize he's got his children there and he's thinking Sean going could put my family at risk, so he might kill me even if rather than me tell anyone he was involved. So it was this dance between me and the owner of the house who we liked, that we were both aware that our lives were in each other's hands. He was protecting me from the Taliban, but he was going to rely on me to protect him from any retaliation from the Americans. So it's a weird relationship.
Complicated, because then, you know...
I think that's what young people call codependent, isn't it?
Codependent.
You're with that boyfriend, girlfriend.
Well, because there's a world where his life would be a lot easier if you had just disappeared then.
Yeah.
So you were relying on his nature to not see that as the...
I was very worried. And you know what? We were both aware. He was aware I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, of course.
That I could risk. And we had this lovely understanding, though. He was a lovely man. He was like this, didn't say much, opposite of me, like blah, blah, blah. But there was a real understanding of two people from other, complete opposites of the world, but this respect, understanding, you know, and I was teaching his 11-year-old boy that, you know, lives were at stake. And he stood up, by the way, I hadn't mentioned, he put his life on the line to protect me from the Taliban. Because they were so taken how I wouldn't give the names of my children. He said to the Taliban, he's got the villagers, he could pull out 100 men with guns in the villages. So the Taliban have to be careful. But he said to the Taliban, we have offered Sean tribal protection. You're not allowed to kill him in our area. Which would have made it, the Taliban couldn't then just shoot me there. They'd have to, it'd be difficult for them.
Mm.
So he'd done that for me because he realized that he said, you know, we like what, you know, your good father or whatever, you know, you're not who we thought you were. So I knew he'd really helped me. My life there was a lot better because him and his wives giving me good food and protecting me. And he was kind of looking at me like, but now you're a risk to me. If you tell the CIA I'm involved in this, they can put a drone strike here.
But what are the Taliban doing at this point? Like, what? Because you said you used the phone to call the broadcaster.
Yeah.
What are the Taliban doing? As in, are they making calls to try and get ransom money for your release?
Yeah.
Was that the purpose of your kidnap for financial gain?
It's a slightly. There's various things happening to kidnap. there might have been various reasons what they're doing. I think generally some commanders thought, yeah, let him do an interview. But then very quickly others were like, no way. But they weren't just interested in a kidnap ransom. They were like, how has this journalist got in contact one or two people away from the leader of this group who's now in charge of Afghanistan? He's really high up. So they're thinking, we need a security. Well, who are these locals he's meeting, these contacts, Mullah Medicated or whoever it is who's helped me? If this journalist can get to us, set up meetings, well, so can our enemies. So part of the reason to capture me was to see, it was to do internal security checks. Who are these people talking to journalists saying, we'll introduce you to the leader of the Taliban group? It was the Haqqani network. And I'd got to people who could meet him directly and say, yeah. So that it was security. What made it very complicated, and then it was like, well, we make some money. You know, Afghans, Taliban were good businessmen, so any chance to make money. Well, something I have to be careful about, but I've always had the feeling that there was this hidden hand in all of this, or this actor off stage, but I was aware of their presence like death. And that's, I was listening to the World Service Radio, they gave me the radio, and I hear American State Department saying, the tribal areas of Pakistan are a terrorist safe haven. It's where Al-Qaeda train and Pakistan's responsible. And then I hear the foreign minister of Pakistan on the BBC radio denying there was any training camps in Pakistan. And as he's denying, I can't hear his denial because you can hear all the training camps in the mountains. There's so much test firing of weapons in the mountains. It's so loud. I have to turn up the radio to hear this guy say there aren't there.
Right.
And I was painfully aware, fuck, I'm caught up. I'm in a dark, strategic, geopolitical world. I'm an embarrassment to Pakistan claiming there are no training camps. And in fact, there was one point we discovered later on when the Pakistan Secret Service find out I'm captured, they're telling the Taliban, what are you doing? Why didn't you kidnap him in Afghanistan? And some people were suggesting, why didn't you kill him and dump his body in Afghanistan? So at one point, the kidnap was about money and security. The next bit was about they're going to kill me and put me. And then I heard this was picked up by British Signet intelligence, you know, eavesdropping. All I know is that the then British Foreign Secretary, on a visit to Pakistan, said, "Look, by the way, there's this British journalist kidnapped, and we know he's in the tribal areas. If he goes missing or killed and found dead in Afghanistan, we will, of course, announce to the world that he was in Pakistan." And I've heard that, and all I know is that short time after that conversation, the Taliban I'm with get a call saying, don't kill him, just release him quickly with some money.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, it sounds almost more frightening how chaotic it was. Like, there wasn't a clear plan of what they wanted to do with you. It was just kind of like, it sounds like it could have gone either way at any moment.
Okay, and that's the life hanging on a thread.
Yeah.
I don't know about chaotic. I didn't get that sense. And I feel quite, even now saying that, I'm not supposed to know about things, but it's just you pick up as a journalist this. But no, there's, I felt very much, another sensation I had is just keep treading water that, I had no control over my life.
Right.
I was going to live or die. But it wasn't chaotic because the Taliban are really well organized. British and Americans are well organized. People were trying to rescue me, very well organized. I could hear the drones flying over, and those were probably filming. So it's not chaos, but there was these, you realize you're on a stage and it's a shadowy world of dark actors and you don't know what's happening. You know, you're in a spy versus spy, strategic. I'm in the tribal areas, which had at that point the most what's called high value targets of Taliban, Al Qaeda terrorists. So there'd be U.S. satellites and drones looking, and I was aware. Well, if they thought I was in the same house as Osama bin Laden, they wouldn't rescue me. They'd fucking hit me as well. Pakistan, who's denying. So you're suddenly in a very complicated, that was the backdrop to my kidnap. So I didn't feel it was chaotic. I just felt, oh my God, there's just too many things happening.
So many elements. So I know that the circumstances regarding your release are quite complex. And am I right in thinking they can't fully be discussed?
But I don't know. It's mainly because I was kept in the. I didn't know what's happening.
Yeah.
So I know negotiations are going on.
Between.
So Channel 4 hired a private company. And actually, some of my friends, local journalists, my fixers, lots of people involved in negotiations. But you don't know who's negotiating. Mm. I didn't know the direct things. What I do know, there wasn't, because the Taliban, I know the Taliban told me they were ordered to just negotiate quickly because I was an embarrassment to Pakistan being there. You know, they were worried it was going to bring too much attention to the terrorist training camps. So it was. They were just told get it over and done with. But yeah, I was never told by Channel 4 how things were done. Mm. I've read about it in the paper.
Sure, but can you talk us through the release? How did you know you were about to be released, and what happened?
Yeah. Well, again, I think last time I was here, didn't I? There was this hearing. It was, again, that charming commander. And I called him Mr. C, like he had the charm of the devil. He enters after 4 months. Well, one thing I know I didn't tell before, and it's a rather dark, macabre story, but Mullah Medicated, who pulled a knife and said, I just want to show you. That was the beginning of my kidnap. He disappeared. I thought he'd been dragged off to his death.
Yes.
Well, he reappears right at the end when I'm told you're going to be released. I'm like, wow, you seem to have recovered. And something remarkable happened, which, you know, so despite all my saying earlier, which is I firmly believe most people around the world are completely normal and people join these groups for understandable reasons. There aren't extremes in our case. But Mullah Medicated is the exception that proves the rule. So when he knows I'm going to release, he says, can I ask you a question? And I'd been interrogated at gunpoint for 3 months. And I'm now looking like Robinson Crusoe. And I'm like, yeah, of course you can ask me a question. Like, well, you haven't asked before. And he said, no, but it's slightly delicate, slightly of an offensive nature. You might take offense. And I started laughing, thinking he's being really polite. But I'm thinking, well, he wasn't so polite when he abducted, kidnapped me. And so I'm like, no, please, whatever you want. And what was it funny about this is this is clearly what the Taliban wanted to know about because all the guards put their guns down. They all sat on my feet. I'm sitting on some little chair and the mullah medicated, all the Taliban put their weapons down and they're looking up because this is the real question. They didn't want to know about what forces Americans had or British. They wanted to know this. And I said, please, whatever you want, go on. He said, are you sure you won't take offense? I went, no. He said, okay, is it true women in the West are free to marry animals?
Oh, my God.
And I'm sitting there, and I look like... And then he pauses. He says, not just any animal, but really small animals as well. Now, this is where I got the death wish. I know I'm about to be released, and this guy, got to be very careful. They don't like you laughing. But I suddenly get the giggles, thinking... It's like that friend in class when you know the teacher says the next person who laughs is in detention. I'm thinking, if I laugh, I'm getting executed. But I suddenly get this giggle thinking, the idea that he could believe women are free to marry animals, but he can't quite believe even small animals. I want to say, yeah, you know, I know lots of women who've married a rhinoceros,
hamsters,
an elephant, but we draw the line at little things. We're not that. But I was trying to stifle my... And I said, no, sorry. No, I'm not sure. Didn't want to lie. I said, why are you asking? He said, well, and it was so exact. He said, well, we read an article and all the Taliban were like nodding. They'd all read the same story about a woman in Holland who married a frog. And I kid you not, I'm looking at my fixer and I say, is this fucking Mullah mad? And he says, no, I've heard the same story. I'm like, oh my God, you're all mad. So I went, no, I don't know. I don't think it's legal to marry frogs in Holland. Where do you read? He said, well, I read this article and slowly it's dawning on me. He said, there was even a photograph of this blonde Dutch woman with a frog.
Oh, but the frog prince.
And I said, was there something odd about that frog? Was it wearing a crown? And he went, yeah.
Oh,
like,
my
I'd read
God.
The same article. And then I realized they've confused the frog prince fairy tale with reality. Now, What's disturbing about that is this mullah was in charge of hundreds of Taliban fighters. So no doubt he's telling his men, look, the Americans will come here, invade our country, rape our women, and they fuck frogs, you know. And I'm like, oh my God, this is, it's not about oil or Guantanamo Bay. They think we're having sex with frogs. When I got back to England, this is how it works. The irony is in the 1950s, America, had, to help Afghans, had translated, to help them as children read, had translated the Frog Prince fairy tale into Pashtun. So it had been given out to every Afghan child to help the West. 50 years later, it's been twisted back by the Taliban to use against us. Anyway, that was before. That's when I thought, that's mullah.
God, thank God they didn't get Goldilocks and the Three Bears. That would have been really
confusing.
Read a lot
of fairy tales. I mean, okay. Grandmother, what great big teeth you got.
Yeah.
Osama, well, no, but the command, that was just before. So I'm reeling from, oh my God, this is what we're fighting.
But at this point, this... Actually, can you tell us the trial thing again? Because I think it's vaguely, I think you did tell it, but it's a nice...
So that was, it was like full circle. So, you know, I'd met the mullah, he drove me, and he turns up just before my day in court. Everything happened inside my cell. I never had to go anywhere because the world came to me. So I meet the mullah, I'm like, tell him about frogs. Then the Taliban commander... And he sort of floats into the room in his long clothes. And he takes himself very seriously. And he sits and asks me to sit opposite him. So I am like on the dock in court. And at this stage, and I know they've come to announce because he had said, we're going to investigate you.
Mm.
And he was very clear when he left. He said, look, don't worry about it. You'll either both die or both live. It's not going to be like those other cases where we let the foreigner live. So I know he's coming. And a few weeks before, I felt like we were going to be released. And I, for the first time, I'd kept my emotions locked down. I let my emotions out. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to see Lukey and Gabriel. My life's going to start again. And then when we weren't released, you crash. And so hope is a really day. So I'm sitting there not wanting to hope that I might be freed. But also, you know, I was completely not worried about being shot or killed. You know, I'd had that conversation with them. I'd asked, do you mind shooting me? Because I got a problem having my head cut. They said, look, don't worry. You know, because I appointed the owner of the house. If it comes to my death, I want you to shoot me. Because we've got on. And he cried with that.
God.
So now I'm in the...
So you'd ask to be shot in the back of the head?
Yeah, because I rather English... I said, I got a slight problem having my throat cut.
Yeah.
Slight. But what happened was, I thought, well, if you're going to be shot, it's nice if someone who you like. So when I pointed him, he cried because he was rather touched that I pointed. But so that had already been got. We've dealt with that. So I'm now with the Taliban judge, and he literally pulls out the rather like when they accused me initially, they read out this scroll. Like on a scroll, you're here by charge. Now he's got this scroll, and I'm sitting there waiting my fate, life or death, and I'm sitting with the fixer. And he says, by order official of the Taliban, Amir, you're hereby found innocent. And he looks at me, and he lets that, you know, so I'm like, you know, it's like that movie. It's like good day. You know, like you got off, and then he draws breath. But the shura, which is the ruling governing council, the shura, the Taliban shura, voted to kill you to stop other journalists trying to do the same thing. And I'm like, oh. So I'm like innocent, but they're going to kill me. And that's when the emotions now are, oh, fuck, I'm going to be killed. I'm not going to see the kids. And just as the emotions are about to burst out, he then, but don't worry about that, because me and the Emir have out, you know, we vetoed the rest of the Shura, and we voted to let you live.
My God.
So so I'd literally been, you're innocent, we're going to kill you, don't worry. So I'm sitting there, and I'm just like a pool of a mess on the carpet. And then he says to my fixer, you know, the shura the governing council of the Taliban found you guilty, but we're going to let you live. And we didn't believe it. But so they separate us. And that's when I'm put in a burqa and given some girls, ladies' shoes, which didn't fit. And I'm looking out the burqa and you can't see anything. And it's like this filter and you're sort of squinting. I'm thinking, wow, not only are they this, they can't see the world. So you're in prison, you can't even see out properly these things. I thought it was ironic that there I am being released and I first taste of what it must be like to be a woman imprisoned in burqas. And that's when the Taliban try. So I'm not really aware of what the negotiations are, but there's a phone call. I'm in a safe house and it was full of wounded Taliban and slightly deranged people who had severe mental health issues. And it was like a macabre final moment. It was so bad I was missing the idyllic place where I'd been kidnapped. Sure. Because they were like people pouring me, like,
oh no.
Yeah, it was really a so strange place. And there was just some people who had been wounded in the head or something. That's when the Taliban are calling whoever might negotiating for me and saying, we've got the package. And that's when I say, because I'd vowed to my fixer not to leave without him. Because we didn't want to be like that Italian.
Yeah.
He was the man I'd mentioned before, we're having those great adventures, the fixer. He being kidnapped with an Italian. The Italians paid for that guy's release and poor Afghan fixer gets killed.
Right.
And I vowed, we're not going to, I promise you. So when I'm hearing the Taliban talking about we've just got one package to deliver, I'm like, no. And I turn to God and, pray, please give me the strength. Because I knew I had about 10 seconds before I was going to say, I'm good, let's go. Because like, every sinew in my body wanted to be released to see my children. But I say, I'm not leaving without my fixer. So, and the guy looked at me, he's like, and at that point, everything's like clockwork. It's very dangerous. They've clearly got a man in an alleyway with a car, someone on a phone, whatever's happening in a hostage release situation. So he didn't. He was like, oh. So he just gets on the other phone and says, right, release the other package. So that's when how me and the fixer were released at the same time.
God.
And this lovely American picked us up and I was crying. But
at that point you were crying? Did you say you were crying?
Yeah, first thing. I couldn't stop blubbing. Because now I've spent 3.5 months of locking down, the battling down your hatches. Well, the minute this lovely American voice says, welcome home, sir, and hands me a donut and a coffee, I start crying. Because you just feel like... But where it was... and again, from my experience in war zones, you don't relax until you're really, you know... But it was when I got to Heathrow and, you know, the hardest point... I don't think I've talked about this before, but the longest day, when you talk about every... a minute can be a lifetime. Actually, you know, I'd refused to give the names of my children, but the worst point was Gabriel turned 4 when I was in captivity. Now, as I was telling you earlier, you feel so connected to your loved ones, and I'm escaping from my cell. That day was the longest day of my life because I, in my head, and I know the time in London, I see him wake up, this little 3-year-old who's just turned 4.
Mm.
Not knowing why daddy's away, because the mum was protecting, but they sent something. And I could see him wake up full of excitement, running into mummy's bedroom, opening presents, looking for where daddy's is. And whenever I was away, I would still send presents with big boxes from Harrods and ribbons and not seeing daddy. And then at lunchtime, thinking daddy's going to come in. And I hadn't. And I had this dreadful, it almost killed me. Is that his last thoughts as he's on his bunk bed and I could see him lying there is, well, maybe daddy doesn't love me.
Mm-hmm.
So when I come back from released and I'm at Heathrow 4 months later and the door's open, there's little Gabriel on his scooter and he rushes straight up. He says, daddy, I'm 4. And I'm like, I know you're 4. And I cried. And I'm hugging him like, I know you're 4 and I'm sorry I didn't call. And that's when, I relaxed. It was all, I was over and done with. Yeah.
It's the first time during a telling of that story that you look like you've actually been hit with a bit of emotion as well.
Yeah, because it's, you know, kids. Because it was the, it's there, it's the, yeah, I mean, I don't want to bring it up again, but it is the, well, so when you go through a very visceral experience, it's, it never quite fades into the past tense, like any trauma. So it actually, less so now, but I, for years after my kiddo, I could close my eyes and be back living that moment with a gun to my head or a knife and feeling people's pain, your loved one's suffering. So it never quite fades and is forever more a present tense.
It's interesting you say that, because the final question I was going to ask you, which has sort of been answered a bit, but what's interesting to me is you've undergone a situation that was like deeply traumatic to people who aren't used to it. You were a little bit more experienced in that world, but not to the extent of the period you went through. But it doesn't feel externally like you wear it on you very much. Like it I would say that I've met quite a lot of people who have who've gone through similar traumatic experiences, and it's quite clear to see the impact it's had.
Really?
But you seem quite a upbeat person, even in the discussion of it. Like, there was a few bits where you were talking about quite bleak stuff and you sort of almost smiled a bit, and I got drawn into laughing at it, because it's like,
I know, it's quite, and some people find that disconcerting, or like, why is he laughing about death?
I didn't feel that. I just felt you come across as somebody who's,
well, it's the unbearable lightness of being.
Sure.
It is you, you don't get over a trauma, and you don't you live with it. And actually, I found it's not unpleasant to people. My family find it odd that I can be looking at, like, it's so lovely on a beach, you know, enjoying some lovely food with friends, you know, because I could have been, you know, having my head. You know, I've just spent I had quite a few friends, colleagues kidnapped, beheaded by ISIS. I can think of them whilst enjoying myself, because they are, that shadow shines. I think it's the when you have that shadow of suffering and death and trauma, it casts a brilliant light on life. It's like a painting. Without the shadows, it's not going to be as beautiful. It was just bland photograph. And so I don't regret anything that happened to me. There's a lot of stuff you carry with you, but it's like Scrooge, you know, in the Christmas Carol. It must have been pretty terrifying having those ghosts at the bottom rattling into the story of the ghost of Christmas past. But he wakes up Christmas Day full of life's joy, but with this added thing, which only suffering and fear and trauma. And what I mean by that is, that was the first time in my life I just had a taste of what millions of people in this world are living through every day. And I heard on the radio when I was captured about this woman in Somalia who was having, every day her husband had to cross three roadblocks to get bread. And she always worried he wouldn't come back. And then she's telling the story to the BBC guy, but of course he gets shot. And she's crying. And I cry listening to that. I'm weeping because for the first time in my life, I know what it's like to live in fear. And I could feel her suffering. So it was my own. And that was an amazing privilege that we in the West somehow turn our backs on the world's suffering, or suffering within our own countries, to make our lives easier. But in fact, you can't really turn your backs on the world's suffering, and it eats away at us. So to open up to other people's suffering and plight through just having tasted myself, well, it carries some pain and baggage, but I'm smiling because you realise how wonderful the world is and how good life is. You know?
Well, look, Sean, it's been an absolutely massive pleasure to meet you again. It's fascinating insight into...
Can I give you a postscript?
You can.
I've seen that the meaning of life, and I thought, I'm going to come back and I'll be across between Jesus Christ, Mother Teresa, I'm going to give all my wealth. A week later, I'm in a bar in London drinking a strawberry daiquiri, doing a line of Coke, thinking my life would be better with a Mercedes.
The end.
That's
So that was Sean Langdon, a documentary maker and journalist, but who is well known for being kidnapped and held hostage by the Taliban. I'm joined now by the episode's director, Josh, and off camera, the producer, Danny. Josh, what were your thoughts?
Really liked him. Really like nice way about him.
So chatty.
So chatty and funny and self-deprecating in his humour. And yeah, I mean, it's like, for me, kind of like starting out in journalism as well, that was kind of like what I thought I was going to do. Did a bit of it and realised, God, no. Mm. So I'm quite
happy.
Like, yeah, literally, yeah. I'm much happier, safer. But yeah, so for me, like, I'm just like drawn to these stories and Iraq, Afghanistan war, and someone that goes there and is gone to make documentaries on the Taliban, and then his kidnapping story is just so, you know, it's so incredible given everything we know about it, and the like what goes on, and then the little intricacies, like him getting fried eggs for breakfast because they asked for it.
Well, the bit about the question about whether Western women are allowed to marry frogs.
Yeah.
I mean, it just shows what, like, the propaganda on both sides, but I mean, that's it's quite an extreme form of it, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly, it's just such a bonkers story, and the motivation of why do it, why go back, the feeling you had just before. I find you hear that a lot, that before the trip you get kidnapped and everyone goes, oh, I had a funny feeling about it, but I don't actually think that's true. I just think that that's hindsight must play with it, because before every trip before to somewhere dangerous, you're going to be a bit worried, and then when it all goes wrong, you're like, oh, I saw that coming.
Yeah, I thought he was great. I really enjoyed talking to him. Fascinating story, great way of telling it. The bit I was trying to get into that I don't think I really did in a satisfactory way was just, why do you do it? Because as a young man trying to prove himself, setting out into that world, I can completely understand it. Going, oh, I'll go to the places no one else will go to and I'll do the things no one else will. But once he had his kids, and, you know, it was clear that they're massively important to him. You know, the only part in the piece where he really showed some really deep emotion was talking about his children. I'm surprised that he still keeps going back. Although I did think by the end he gave a very articulate and interesting answer about the fact that you can only really appreciate the joy in the world when you've seen the true darkness of it.
How did we think that I was going to act through that when there was a fact about Westerners marrying frogs?
Oh, I was going to spring that on you. Yeah.
All I did was nod and smile.
I was sitting here going, what the fuck's that about? When, how did that come in the last meeting? Okay, so would you have ever gone, Ben? Like, even when you were younger, can you imagine going to a war zone?
No, definitely not. Like, I'm very risk averse as a person, and something like that, to do it for the sake of a job, even if I really believed I was uncovering something really important, it just wouldn't have been, the payoff wouldn't have been worth the risk for me. What about you? I mean, no. You did journalism as a degree.
Yeah, I did journalism. I was more into football than war. I couldn't imagine going to somewhere where your life would be in danger. Mm. Like, it feels so strange to run toward trouble.
Mm.
And that's what he does.
Mm-hmm. I liked his first job, DJ correspondent.
Mm. Pete Tong interviews.
Yeah, just like, so, charge expenses. And he was like, yeah, I get that, not feeling the meaning of it, but it's an odd choice to go from that to chasing war zones, probably, you know, less money, higher career.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, for me, it was, the takeaway was just how to try and appreciate, in terms of how big the world is, how many people are in it, how few people have the daily life that we have. In terms of when he was talking about being with his fixer, who was a native to that area, and him saying, oh, I think it'll be okay, and the fixer go, no, we're dead. It was just kind of like, for people in that life, the fixer knew that the chances were they were going to die because the price of life there is so low.
And he thought it was so high.
But he was in the wrong place. And it's just trying not to take things for granted, I suppose.